The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
From the crossroads of Merrick Avenue and Sunrise Highway in beautiful Merrick, Long Island, New York, this is Sports Talk New York on WGBB, 1240 AM, 95.9 FM. I'm your host, Mike Guidone, joined as always by the man we call Cappy, my co-host. 516-623-1240. Again, that's 516-623-1240 is the number. I have an exciting show for you tonight, a little Mets hot stove action with a former New York Met, Dave Magadan. Going to talk a little Hofstra soccer with their head coach. They're making a run in the NCAA tournament. Before we do any of that, welcome to my man, Cappy. How you doing tonight?
Very good. We're in November, getting closer to Thanksgiving. Very thankful for everything going on in our lives and excited for tonight. It should be fun. I did have to throw a little shout-out. Today we had the flag football second-grade championship, and players Casey Charlie, Anthony Bodie, Michael Alejandro, Angelo, Gio, and Henry, and coaches Mike and Bill helping me out, pulled out the 13-10 championship win today. It was a lot of fun.
That's wonderful. It's good to get a New York football win because we don't get too many of those, that's for sure, in this area.
They just keep you, they keep you watching until you get some extra time, and then things fall apart in New York.
Absolutely. But there's a lot of Mets baseball news that we'll go through later on, but we're going to bring out right now. We're very lucky to be joined by member of the 86 Mets. He was very early in his career and then stayed with the team, had a long and very distinguished career in the major leagues and as a player and then later on as a coach. None other than Dave Magadan is going to join us on the program. Dave, Mike, and Chris here in New York, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
We're doing wonderful, thanks. We're just thrilled to have you on, and we thank you for joining us. I know we'll get you off before the Tampa Bay Bucks game starts tonight. I know you said you're a big fan, and we'll be pulling for them as well. But very happy to have you on the show tonight.
Well, it's great to be with you guys, and hopefully with this interview, you'll bring my Bucks some good luck tonight.
We'll certainly try. Chris, as a matter of fact, in a small world, was in Buffalo last week.
Yep, watching the game.
Yeah, he goes everywhere. We're based here on Long Island, but we're thrilled to have you on. So, Dave, we'll start off. You were drafted 1980 by the Red Sox, decided not to sign with them and go to college, and then drafted by the Mets. At that time, was that a difficult decision for you to make to turn that down at that point, or were you pretty confident once you went to school that your draft stock would improve?
It really wasn't a tough decision. Coming out of high school, I was young. I was 17 years old when I graduated. Actually, when I got to Alabama, I didn't turn 18 till September of that fall baseball season. So I was not ready to go to pro ball. I was 6'2", maybe 175 pounds soaking wet, so I didn't feel like I was physically ready. I didn't feel like I was emotionally ready. Never really been away from home, so I think, going to Alabama gave me an opportunity to, kind of grow into being a man, and both emotionally and physically I got stronger. It gave me some time to, lift weights and put some weight on my body, and when we started that fall season, that first year at Alabama, I quickly recognized that I was a little bit overmatched that first fall. We had, fifth-year seniors that were throwing, mid-90s, and, they were knocking the bat out of my hand. So I knew that I had to get stronger and quickly, and fortunately for me, I got the opportunity right away. I was able to play.
Well, you had a wonderful career, in college. You were elected to the College Baseball Hall of Fame in 2010, and then right off that amazing career there, you drafted by the Mets, 32nd overall, and you report to professional baseball. Talk a little bit, if you can, just about the transition of going from, high level college, but then you're professional. How that was for you, and what you thought of that at that time.
It was a little bit like what I experienced going from high school to college, where when I showed up in Columbia, South Carolina to report to my low A ball team. I think we were playing the Toronto Blue Jays affiliate, and there was a kid throwing on the mound that was throwing the ball all over the place, but he was in the mid to upper 90s, and I hadn't seen a whole lot of that, and even in college. And, you know, using a wooden bat, hadn't really used a wooden bat ever, maybe when I was in Little League a little bit, but always using an aluminum bat. So, you know, just the weight of the bat, the sweet spot being smaller, and these guys throwing the ball all over the place, it was a transition for me at the beginning. You know, it took me a couple weeks, probably at a bare minimum, to get used to the velocity that I was facing on an everyday basis, and then just getting used to that wooden bat.
We're talking with Dave Magnin again, played for the Mets. So, Dave, you were drafted by the Mets in 83, and then in September of 1986, you were called to fill in for Keith Hernandez, who was ill, and you got three hits that night. A lot of us saw some signs on the side that said, Keith who? Dave Magnin. What was it like for you to get that call up, and then kind of what was your role for the rest of that year? How did you kind of manage that situation?
I think we were all just, as the call-ups, I think four of us got called up in that September from the AAA team, and we were just trying to, you know, we knew that they had a big lead, and, you know, they had their vibe going, and, you know, they were running away with the division. We just didn't want to get in anybody's way, and, you know, just kind of went about our business. And coming back from, I think we were coming back from St. Louis, and we had lost like six games in a row, and all we needed to do was win one game or the Phillies lose a game for us to clinch the division, and we kept losing and they kept winning. So coming back from St. Louis, Davey came up to my seat and said, hey, you're going to play tomorrow. I thought he was joking. And he goes, no, Keith is really sick and looks like he's got the flu, so we're going to give him a day. So you're going to get the Cubs tomorrow. Eckersley is going to be pitching, so just be ready to go. And, you know, obviously when we got back, I couldn't sleep a wink and, you know, worried about my first big league start. And, you know, thank goodness everything turned out okay.
Well, I'm going to date myself here a little bit, Dave, but I'm a senior in high school that year, and everyone here, as you know, on Long Island, New York Mets fans, and just so excited. And my teacher let us, you know, watch the games during the day, and we'd talk about them the next day. And you really were, at least in my school, you really were a folk hero, because you came. It was a tough stretch there for the Mets, and you had a big game. They clinch, and you know, not that anybody was really worried that the team was going to lose, but really you kind of threw it back to a great timing for them, and everybody was very excited. So that, you know, getting those three hits that night and helping clinch, it had to be kind of surreal, I'm sure, for you as a newer player on the team, as you said.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, I think I probably got two or three more starts after that, just to give guys a day off, give Keith a day off. And I was probably more nervous about playing first base, because I had played first base my first year and a half in the minor leagues, but my last 2 years in the minors, AA and AAA, I strictly played third base. Mm-hmm. So when Davey came up to me and said I was going to be starting at first, I was like, oh my God, do I even have a first baseman? I didn't even know if I brought one with me. So so that was probably what I was mostly scared about, but you know, it was a great experience, and to have my first big league start, to be in a big game like that. I mean, there was no doubt that we were going to clinch the division at that point. I think we had a 14-game lead, but it was nice to be a part of history.
And then your team goes on to win the World Series. You come back the next couple of years, and you saw some playing time, but it's often behind Keith Hernandez at first and Hojo at third. How did you transition to that role until maybe 1989, when maybe you got some time, and then the Mets go out and get Eddie Murray, and now you always seem to have somebody in your way? How did you manage that situation?
Well, I was in the big leagues, so that was great, and you know, and I had some really good mentors that helped me along the way. I had Tim Tuffle, I had Lee Mazzilli, especially Lee Mazzilli, who kind of gave me a mindset of how to pinch hit.
Right.
Certainly at the age of 23, 24, that's not what you want to be doing. But like he told me, he said, hey, if it's going to keep you in the big leagues and you can show these teams that you can hit off the bench, you'll play for a long time. And certainly that was a big factor in me being able to have a long career. So, you know, I think when I originally that 1987 season. I had a good year, but I think I started off like 0 for. Oh, I hit a home run my first pinch hit at bat, and then I think I went 0 for my next 15, ooh. And it was like really frustrating. You know, 0 for 1, 0 for 1, 0 for 1, 0 for 1.
You get one
and
chance.
I was like, yeah, you know, and it was like, and I was beating myself up about it, and finally Mass came up to me and talked to me about, you know, hey, you know, you get that one chance. It's like a pass fail. And if you pass, if you fail, forget about it. Turn the page, go on to the next day, and you've got to really, you know, take it like that. Just cut it into individual, just one at bat, and then you can. It's easier to turn the page after, you know, an 0-for-1 or whatever happens. So, and he, you know, he was always in my corner. He always gave me words of encouragement, and that was huge in my career.
And he'll be inducted into the Mets Hall of Fame this year. That's Lee Mazzilli.
So earlier this year, the Mets family lost Davey Johnson, as it was a great loss for baseball. Can you just for a sec just tell what it was like having him as your first big league manager? And you know, you talked a lot about Lee Mazzilli, but just what Davey meant to you and as a professional?
Well, I mean, obviously Davey gave me my first chance to go out there and play. You know, it was always a battle. Trying to get playing time on that team just because we had so many good players. And then Hojo comes out that 1987 season and goes 30-30 and establishes himself as a great Mets player. And, you know, we had Keith there till the end of, I think his last year was the end of 89, I believe.
Yes.
So, I mean, I had really good players in front of me. So I just took it as, you know, I'm going to try and do the best that I can do with the at-bats that I get. I'm going to get my opportunity sooner or later, whether it was through injury or just moves being made. And then finally in 1990, I was able to get a lot of playing time just because of the, you know, Keith not coming back. And you know, I was going to, you know, fight with Mike Marshall over playing time that year. And then he ended up getting hurt, and I finally got my opportunity.
Again, we're talking with Dave Magadan here. So, Dave, it wasn't just with the Mets. You had 16 seasons with 7 different teams playing first and third base. What do you think kind of led to your longevity in the major leagues? The ability to hit, the ability to be versatile, you know, the ability to be a pinch hitter at times. Like, how did you stick around for that long?
I think it was a little bit of everything. I showed at, you know, at the age of 23, 24 years old, that I was going to be able to hit off the bench, and that was a valuable commodity on teams in the National League, because I was going to be able to hit for the pitcher, and I was going to, you know, I think I had the type of approach at the plate where you can sit me for, you know, 4, 5, 6 days, and I can still come off and give you a good at bat. I think I hit over 250 for a career as a pinch hitter, and that's not too shabby. Mm-hmm. I think I improved defensively. I think early on when I got to the big league, it was probably a little bit of a liability defensively, but I showed that I can play first base at an above average level, third base a little bit above average. So they didn't, you know, a lot of the teams I played for didn't have a problem with me, you know, if I didn't play for a few, you know, for, you know, 5, 6, 7 games, it can stick me out there to play third or first, and I was going to be able to hold my own defensively. And I think I was a good teammate. You know, I wasn't a guy that was going to complain a lot about whether I was playing a lot or not. And when I got the opportunity to play after sitting for a long period of time, I was able to do a pretty good job. And I think those are probably the 3 biggest reasons I was able to play as long as I did.
So, Dave, you can bring a very unique perspective to being a member of a first-year franchise, as you started opening day for the Florida Marlins in their first season. What was it like being a member of an inaugural franchise? Major League Baseball hadn't expanded for quite some time, and here there's 2 new teams coming out, and you're starting for Florida on day one. What was it like with that franchise?
It was a great experience. Me being a Floridian, I was going to be able to play close to home.
Yeah.
And we weren't bad. I think when I ended up getting traded that July, my first year with the Marlins, we were right around 500. So we were playing very, very good baseball. we were getting, you know, 30,000-40,000 fans at every game at Joe Robbie Stadium. So it was a really good experience for me, playing close to home and having a pretty good year, and then finally getting a chance to play every day. You know, I did play in 1990, 91 with the Mets, but then I 92 I started kind of platooning a little bit, and then it was kind of looking like I wasn't going to get an opportunity to play every day ever again, and to be able to go down to Miami and play in my home state and get those regular at bats, it was fantastic.
That's great.
So, Dave, I'm going to go back to your college days. 1983 College World Series, your final college game. You go 2-for-4 with a single off Roger Clemens and a double off Schiraldi, which is pretty strange that that's the matchup that the Mets wound up having in the 1986 World Series. You batted .525 that year, if I'm not mistaken. Could you explain what it was like facing those guys at that time and how you were able to bat over .500 in college?
You know what? I get that question asked a lot, and, you know, it's such a blur to me. First of all, it was a long time ago.
Okay.
I think, you know, I'd had two really good years as a freshman and a sophomore, and going into my junior year, I knew that was going to be the year I could, you know, I could get drafted, and it was obviously a very important year for me, and I really worked hard, not only, you know, trying to get stronger and trying to become even a more consistent hitter. The guy that played third base for us that year, Brett Alvin, he was our leadoff hitter, and literally after every practice we had in the spring, we would go to the indoor batting cage and we would throw to each other and we would try and get each other out. I mean, we would throw sliders and curveballs and changeups, and, you know, we'd throw from a close distance. And we did that after every practice. And it really, I think, was a huge reason why I had the year that I had. He had a historic year for a Crimson Tide team also as our leadoff hitter. And that was a huge reason why I was able to do that. And it's funny because when I got into pro ball, you know, not my first half season, but the next year in Lynchburg, I played with Paul Hollins, who was Dave Hollins' older brother.
Cincinnati Reds.
And, yeah, and we were kind of muddling through the first month of the season, and I was like, hey, you know what we did? And I talked, you know, I told him about our, you know, the guy that at Alabama, Brad Alvin, that we threw at each other. So we did that the whole first half of that season in Lynchburg. And I think he had 19 home runs at the All-Star break, and I was hitting over .400 at the All-Star break in the Carolina League that year. But we just couldn't keep it up because it was so tiring and it was so much work to do that, like, you know, after batting practice, go in the cage and throw to each other, and, you know, but it was a testament to what, you know, hard work and doing a drill like that that's going to make you, you know, it's going to prepare you for every game, you know, the rewards you can get from doing that.
Once again, Dave Magenin joining us. And Dave, once you retired with the Padres, you became a minor league hitting instructor for them and eventually working your way up to being the hitting coach for the big club. Was coaching something that was on your mind, you know, even as a young guy? Or, you know, obviously as you were kind of coming to the end of your career, was that something that you really thought, you know what, this is what I want to do next with my baseball career?
I'd never really thought about it as a younger player, but as I got older and, you know, more and more players, teammates of mine were coming up to me and asking me for hitting advice or, you know, what approach to have at the plate and stuff like that, and finally when I got to San Diego and Kevin Towers was our general manager, and he came up to me my last year and he said, hey, do you want to play anymore? I'm like, well, you know, I think I got maybe one more year in me. And he's like, well, we're not going to have any room for you with the Padres, but go ahead and file for free agency, and if nothing comes up, we want to make you the hitting coordinator in the minor leagues. We're going to hold the spot open for you. If it works out, you don't get a free agent contract, we'll hold the spot open for you with that hitting coordinator job. And he said, I guarantee you, within the next 2 or 3 years, you're going to be our big league hitting coach. And he didn't lie. I ended up not signing as a player, went and became the hitting coordinator for a year, and then that following season, I was the hitting coach for the Padres.
And Dave, you mentioned to us that, you know, someone, as a player, people were coming up to you and asking you for some hitting advice. But from what we seem here, you seem to be a hitting coach that tries to help each person individually, not a one fit style for everybody. You were the hitting coach for guys like Jacoby Ellsbury, Dustin Pedroia winning a World Series. What was it about your style, and what type of hitters do you think you had the most influence on as a hitting coach?
I think as a major league hitting coach, I think there's too much talk about how you're always making swing changes with guys to make them better and all that. Certainly that's a part of it, but I think as a major league hitting coach, I think you have to understand all 15 to 20 guys that you're going to have throughout the year. You have to understand what's going to make them the best that they can be, what are they going to be able to handle, what type of hitter they can be, how do they fit into the offensive philosophy of our team, because I think that's very important for a major league hitting coach, right? It's to develop a plan of attack against a pitcher that night or whoever's coming out of the bullpen, and how, as a team, you're going to attack that pitcher and try and score runs that night. And it's a little bit of all those things. Obviously, it's a little bit of being a psychologist and, you know, trying to get in somebody's head when they're struggling and trying to get them out of it. But I think it's to think that a hitting coach is only about making swing changes and, you know, thinking that it's going to turn around a guy every time. It's a lot of other things that are involved in being a major league hitting coach.
Could you just tell us real quick what it was like winning a World Series as a coach with Boston that year? It had to be an unbelievable experience. Finally, you know, taking away the Eastern Division from the Yankees, but just winning a World Series in Boston.
Yeah, it was incredible. I was a hitting coach in San Diego, like I mentioned earlier, for 4 years, and then I was fired in the middle of that 2006 season, and I was devastated. I'd never been released as a player, and to be fired in the middle of a season like that, it was just devastating. I was like, I didn't even know what to do. That drive from San Diego back to Florida was a long one, and I was wondering where my career was going to go. But as soon as I got back home, about a week later, Theo Epstein gave me a call and said that he didn't know what he had for me, but he wanted to bring me in the organization. He wanted to bring me in for interviews, and they hired me as an assistant to baseball ops in the minor leagues, and by the end of that offseason, I was a major league hitting coach with the Red Sox. So to go from where I was in the middle of the summer of 06 to a year and a half later winning a World Series with the Boston Red Sox, I mean, it just doesn't get any better than that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dave, a favorite teammate or a favorite coach that you had throughout your time in the majors?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, Ron Washington was a big favorite of mine. He was a big reason why I went from Boston to Texas when he was the manager of the Rangers. He was probably the only guy I would have left the Red Sox for. So he was a big favorite of mine, both as a coach when he was our third base coach in Oakland when I was playing there, and then when I coached for him in Texas, it was a great experience. As far as a player that I played with, Luis Gonzalez, I think was a lot of fun. He was a great teammate, kept things loose and played with him in Chicago and Houston. Mark Grace, I love playing with. It's hard to pick, you know, just one guy, but those guys come to mind just because they were not only really good players and made our team very good, but they were really good in the clubhouse, and they were a glue that kept everybody together in the clubhouse.
So we promised we'd get you to kick off for the Bucks and the Rams. But just one last question, Dave, if you may, just how you view baseball right now? Are you thinking about maybe getting back into the major league level, or have you pretty much put a cap on that? And what are your plans going forward?
Yeah, no, I think I'm good doing what I'm doing now, just playing golf two or three times a week and watching my Bucks. And
good for you.
I do still watch baseball. I think it's getting better. I think for a while there, it was almost unwatchable with all the strikeouts and swinging and missing and pop-ups. But I think this last postseason, I think, was different. You know, two teams got into the World Series that were a little bit more about, you know, making adjustments and hitting line drives and, you know, not striking out, putting the ball in play. And I think it certainly makes baseball a lot more watchable.
Well, as Mets fans, we really enjoyed watching you play throughout the late 80s, early 90s. And it was a pleasure reliving some of that stuff tonight, too. So thank you very much.
Hey, guys, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. It was really our pleasure. Dave Magonin, former New York Met, College Baseball Hall of Famer, and once again, we wish you all the best, and thanks so much, Dave.
All right, thank you.
Absolutely. Great having him on. Just, you know what, and I think we got it. It was an 8:25 kickoff.
That kickoff, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know what, I mean, I have to tell you, and you know this, because we here on this show, we get our own guests. We don't have a producer, and some people are harder to track down than others. A lot you never hear, you get a name or a number or an email or whatever else. Dave Magonin was the easiest guy to deal with.
Nice.
He's as good a guy, I'm assuming, off the air as he sounded. He could not have been better dealing with it. He was always, just as cool as he sounded on the air.
From what I know, he used to ride the 7 line to work and show up at games, talk with people on the train, just the down-to-earth guy. And I think that's why Met fans enjoyed having him around for a while.
And I think it's no secret also why he had a 16-year career.
As he said.
I mean, he said he wanted to be known as
a good teammate.
Right. So here's a guy driving home having just been fired, and Theo Epstein calls him and says, look, I don't know what I got for you, but I want you in this organization. And then a year later, he's the hitting coach.
Getting a ring.
Yeah, it says a lot. It's nice that nice guys do finish first. So Dave Magonin, great player, and always has a little bit of – I didn't want to bring this up, but he's the answer to a very interesting trivia question.
Okay.
So I said, Dave, do you know who the last player to hit against Nolan Ryan was? It was him. He was batting against Nolan Ryan, Nolan's last year, on a pitch. Apparently, if I remember correctly, Nolan Ryan snapped a ligament in his elbow, and that was it. Yeah,
that's
so
right.
he was the last guy to bat against Nolan Ryan. But I'm always fascinated, too, and I appreciated what he said about the Marlins, because I thought – back in those days, that was so exciting to have new teams. And there was a big question whether Florida would support Major League Baseball, because it was always spring training.
Yeah.
And they did. And they still do. I mean, fortunately, it's amazing.
They have turnover every couple of years,
I mean, Joe Robbie Stadium, I went to a baseball game there. It was a terrible baseball stadium.
It was a football stadium.
Yeah, and what they have now in Miami is just gorgeous. But
they were trying to throw knuckleballers out there, Orestes Destrada, all these random guys just to field the team.
And I think Charlie Huff was the opening
day
starter,
Huff,
right?
Yeah. And then eventually they won a World Series, and they blow it up. That's what they do down there.
They get prospects, and then they trade them off, and then – I don't know what the answer is, but he certainly enjoyed playing his time. So there is some other New York Met news here today, which with Brandon Nimmo being apparently traded, he does have a no-trade clause, but we'll get into that in the second half hour.
I think he waived it already.
It's not going to be announced.
We'll talk about that at some point, but as you can tell, that's going to be a direction that the Mets are going.
Yeah, definitely. We'll get into a little football also with the Jets and Giants. Giant game, a little bit more exciting than the Jet game today. But our guest in the second half hour is going to be the head men's soccer coach from Hofstra University, Rich Nuttall, who they have now gone 2-for-2, Briss, in the
NCAA tournament, yes.
Two road victories, beat the number one team in the country today.
Correct.
Who would think that Vermont would have the number one soccer?
Well, I think that's something we could talk to him about.
You don't think, I mean, It's cold up there.
Yeah, it is. I think it was kind of snowing today, but yeah. It'll be fun.
So he'll join us in the second half hour. We'll dive into everything New York sports when we come back here on WGBB Sports Talk New York, and looking forward to the second half hour with it.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
And welcome back to the second half hour of Sports Talk New York here on WGBB. I'm your host, Mike Udonald, joined with my co-host, Chris Cap Caputo. And right now, we're very happy to be joined by head men's soccer coach from the pride of Long Island, Hofstra University, Mr. Rich Nuttall. And they've gotten two big, huge upsets. They're the Cinderella story so far of the NCAA tournament. Coach, welcome, and thanks for joining us on short notice.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Oh, absolutely.
Coach, this is supposed to be a farewell tour for you this year, year 37, I believe, at Hofstra. And
yeah.
The team, gets an at-large bid to the NCAA tournament. Thursday night, you drive up to Syracuse, New York, and, outscore them 2-0. And then today, you make the drive all the way up to Vermont. I'm sure the weather was not perfect up there. And, start out giving up an early goal, came back to score two late, and then unfortunately give up one late to head to overtime. But can you talk a little bit about the elation of the last two games, especially today's overtime win?
Well, super proud. We've beaten an ACC team away, thoroughly deserved to win that game, and we felt comfortable and played very well. And then we've gone up to the number one team in the country. They were 29 games unbeaten from last year. They were the reigning national champs, the number one seed. And it's been a magnificent game. Credit to Vermont. They're very talented, and credit to Hofstra as well. We gave them a real good game and competed in all aspects and, managed to get ahead 2-1 late in the game and gave up a goal late to them. They're a big group of boys, and they're tough to defend at corners, and they've got one with 5 minutes to go. But we've shown mental resilience, and I'm proud of how we responded in overtime. They could have withered, and they didn't. And they stood up, and they got a winner. After about 8 to 9 minutes, and it's golden goal. So the ball goes in the back of the net, and you're running off and celebrating. So incredibly proud of the team and their character and their resilience.
So are you guys on your way back from Vermont right now?
Yeah, well, I'm on a bus. We're driving the 6-hour drive now.
The glamour of Division
I. It's not so bad when you win.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I'm sure it's more fun.
Well, we appreciate you joining us. Chris has another question for you.
So, Coach, you played these guys last year in the NCAA tournament and lost 2-1 and then in round two. And then you played them again in a non-league game earlier this year that was nothing at halftime. So you had already made that trip up to Vermont. Do you think that kind of helped you already seeing this team last year and also making the trip in September up there?
Yeah, last year's game was in the same, second round of the NCAAs, and we felt that we were the better team on the night. A couple of things didn't go our way, but this time we went up, this season, they were definitely better on the day, but since the day we played them, we went on a nine game win streak. So, we've evolved, they've evolved, and playing on that field, each surface you play on, if you can play on it early, you get used to it a little bit. So we knew what to expect, and then it was very wintry conditions, no flurries and a little bit of wind and a bit of rain, and it was difficult. And difficult for both teams, and it was, I think, you know, the crowd, a real good crowd, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 crowd were really into it. I give them credit. And it was a brilliant game, I think, for the fans. Maybe not for the coaches, but for the fans, it was end-to-end and some great stuff played by both teams.
Coach, could you talk just a little bit about your team and the makeup of it? And you know, it seems you're a little top-heavy with scoring. Just about how you approach the game and what your team is built on?
Yeah, I think our team is built on the sum of the parts. You know, I have two brilliant assistants who are great educators, and we do play very well as a defensive unit. We've got 3 or 4 class defenders. And then I think the other part of strength to our team is our 2 centre forwards were a very good team. So 3 or 4 class defenders, then put worker bees around them, and we're a very effective unit, you know. I wouldn't say individually it's the most talented team I've had, but I would say it's probably the best fit, you know, all the pieces fit really well together. So they work hard going both ways, and I think one of our secrets, of course, they run fast going forward, but they get back well and get back into a defensive unit well. They've got a great work ethic, so... again, I think it's more of a sum of the parts team than it is incredibly special players all over the field. And I'm proud of that. You know, we're a true team.
Again, we're talking with Richard Nuttall from Hofstra Men's Soccer. So, Coach, you pulled 2 games off, and now you're going to go back. And can you explain to me kind of how this week goes as you now prepare for, I believe, the number 16 seed Furman next week? Like, this is, you know, you were supposed to collect your last paycheck and move on. What's it like for you now this week as you go in? Is this fun?
Yeah, well, you know, I agreed that I wanted to with the powers that be at Hofstra. I told them I'd like it to be my last season and make it a planned situation. And it's fun. I don't want to give up. I want to keep going. And, you know, every day I get to come in work and still be the head coach is a wonderful thing. But the new head coach, Stephen Rose, taking over, is a very, very, very good coach. And I'm really pleased to be passing the program on to him. But I'll enjoy every moment while I'm still in charge, and it's a great journey, a great ride, and these days will live with you forever, you know. Today's a special day, beating the number one team in the country, and it's just euphoric, to be honest, for all the guys and all the staff. So I'm enjoying it, taking it day by day. I've got another week's employment where I'm the head coach, and thoroughly happy to be doing so.
Well, as well you should enjoy that moment, because that's tremendous. I don't want to look too far ahead and you know, put the pin in the balloon, but I'm figuring you've beaten the number one team in the nation, defending champs. How do you prepare for the next game when you've already kind of, you know, done something that maybe you weren't sure you were going to, or the guys weren't sure they were going to be able to do?
Yeah, I think in the top 30 or 40 teams in D1 soccer, there's so much parity, you know, and it's minute moments that divide them from 1st to 10th, 10th to 30th, or, you know, 20th to 40th. So anybody can beat anybody in the top 40. We realize we're going to be playing the Furman team, who's very, very good. If you look at the record, some of the opponents have beaten all year. They're talented, so... we ain't looking past one Furman. Furman's is our new focus, and it could be a very, very difficult game. We're at their place on their surface, and they've got some talent. They've got some team speed. They've got some special players. So it's you know, sorry about the noise on the bus.
Oh no, but, don't worry about it.
Yeah, you know, it's again next Sunday that we'll work towards in our regular way.
Coach, I think it's just a great story. Could you just let us know, you know, at some point you tried to make Coach Roach the coach in waiting. When was it that you decided that this was going to be your last year, and how did you come to that decision?
Yeah, it was mainly with my wife. I've had 37 years of really no evenings and weekends free, and this job, it's not really a job, it's a way of life. My parents are farmers, and they're in a way of life, and being a head coach, you know, it's a way of life where you're just 24/7. So, you know, we've got some lovely children, and we want to have a little bit of time to ourselves. I'm 62, and hopefully we'll like each other, because we've not spent much time together, you know.
Yeah, so, to reintroduce each other.
Yeah. Coach, so, you know, it's exciting. And again, these two, my two assistants, are tremendous. They deserve it. And again, I've still got loads of energy. I'm going to be working with the athletic department in development.
Nice.
So
I'm
a 9-to-5-er after this season. And hopefully I'll like it. If I don't like it, maybe I'll go back into it. You never know, do you?
Absolutely.
Coach, I don't get to necessarily watch the games, but I was following a little bit of today, and I looked at some of the games, and, you know, as Mike said before, you got one guy with 13 goals, another guy with 12 goals, and today you got some help from guys who maybe don't normally score. So the first thing is, kind of, how does that come about that you get a guy scoring his second goal of the season in an NCAA tournament game? How do those guys find a way to step up and score for you guys in these type of games?
Yeah, it's just some of the parts that we've already spoken about. Everybody doing the job, and soccer is a fluid game, you know. And to be honest, the two main goal scorers that we've got, Danny and Laurie, get a lot of attention. So at times it gives the ones who are on the edge, the periphery, time to shine and get in there when they're maybe not being as closely looked at on the field. And playoff games, it's a different story, and just everybody gives everything. And credit to, I think it was Pablo who scored, and then our defender scored a cracking ball too, you know. So, and they're just getting, they're the foresight to get, be in the right place at the right time, and with energy getting in the box and getting the end and things. It was two great goals that they scored. But I don't want to take away from the last goal. It was a magnificent goal, too, you know.
Can I ask a little bit of strategy? I like the whole strategy. I believe soccer, you're allowed to make a certain amount of subs, you know, during certain stoppages of play. So you're only allowed a certain amount. So it's a lot of strategy. And, you know, you have to use that throughout the game. And one of the things you did was switch your goalkeeper at halftime today. How do you come to a decision in a 1-0 game that maybe you make that type of decision?
Yeah, I mean, things evolve sometimes. The season evolves, and we brought this keeper in, Sean Bourne, who from a D2 program or NIA program. He's a magnificent keeper. And after 4 games, he broke his finger. So the Rudy story we've got is Gino Savone, the Franklin Square boy, who's been with us for 4 years, who had only played 20 minutes, and he had to play. He had to play, and he's done really, really well. Sorry, guys. And he's... he's got certain qualities as the other one has. So, you know, playing Gino the first half and Sean the second half makes sense at the moment to who we are and what we are. You know, probably Gino's better in crosses and short stopping, and Sean's, he manages the game well, and his kicking's magnificent. So there's good and bad from both of them, but we're happy to share the time at the moment.
Coach, just one last thing before we let you get back to the ride and the boys. You started in 1989 in Hofstra, and could you just talk just about a little of the growth of the whole sports and athletic department there at Hofstra, not only the facilities but just the department itself?
Well, listen, I've said this about the Board of Trustees at Hofstra. What they've done every year I've been there, they've grown. And they haven't done it. They haven't tried to do it too fast and too soon, but each year we've been there. I've seen growth, and from the facilities to the people to the professors to the whole footprint of the university has just grown every year, and I'm proud to be an employee of Hofstra. I think they've done a magnificent job. I think they're financially stable, as I understand it, with their what you call the endowment, or whatever you call it. They've done a magnificent job of not growing too fast and too soon, but just growing every single year in all ways. And, again, very proud to be a Hofstra employee.
Well, I'm a Hofstra grad, grad school, and very proud of the school and of your program. And we sincerely hope that the ride continues for you. I don't know how much you have left on the bus, but watch that rest stop food as you're heading home. But certainly enjoy the moment. You certainly very well deserved, Coach.
We appreciate it.
I appreciate it, guys. Thanks so much.
We appreciate the time. Take it game by game. Enjoy it. And, you know, work on the little stuff this week and get yourself another win. And hopefully you'll have another trip after this week as well.
Yeah, brilliant, fellas. I appreciate you showing interest in us. And thanks very much for interviewing us and letting us get the Hofstra men's soccer name out there. Thank you.
Awesome.
Our pleasure. Coach Richard Nuttall from the, as we said, the pride of Long Island. What a great story. I mean, this is the stuff, you know, unfortunately, I don't want to rag on Newsday, but where are they? I mean, you know, I'm sure tomorrow they'll have, you know, half a page. But
they beat the number one team in the nation, who is the reigning national champs.
And they have a coach who is in his last year.
He's in his last year.
Oh, my Lord. And, I mean, having when you – back in 1989, 90, when Hofstra, the school was very – I mean, facilities-wise for athletics, still pretty small.
Yeah.
You know, football was still – basketball, they hadn't built the arena yet. I mean, he probably was playing on some backfield before they built the lacrosse and football stadium. And now, I mean, I don't know how many people they get, but good for them that they had 3,000-5,000 students up there today, you know, watching the game.
Yeah, I think probably 70 of them were Hofstra people.
Right.
But for Vermont, you know, I think what it is with soccer now is you're able to go out there, and I don't know what it's like to recruit, Mike. It's nothing like what you and I had to try to do. But they're out recruiting, you know, with – I don't know what kind of funds, trying to bring people in from different countries and steal them from Division II schools and whatever, trying to compete. But you can get good soccer players to come to a mid-major, and you can then compete with the Dukes and the Michigans and the Notre Dames and things like that because you have some of the same resources. And soccer is a game where if you get a couple of kids that can score and you get some guys that are good defensively, you could stay in a game and win 1-0.
Sure.
And that's why the NCAA tournament is such a crapshoot.
Yeah, and I certainly was not going to ask him this question, but I wonder if teams try to pilfer his best players, like, you know, the Dukes, the North County, the Syracuses, look to the mid-majors, and since they have a few bucks maybe, and they try to get his guys.
I'll tell you this. The Pitt women's coach is probably grabbing the Scranton women's players and trying to get them. So if you did not hear, the Division III Scranton women beat Pitt Division One in an exhibition game. And, Mike, it just can't happen.
Well, if you're the Pitt...
They are good.
If you're the Pitt coach, you might be keeping that seat warm for the Scranton coach for next year. Because that's an impressive program. But, yeah, that was a crazy story.
And those are the situations where literally in the handshake line, people are saying, hey, you know, why don't you come here? I got money for you. I'm an ACC school.
Yeah, it's it's wild. But to see Hofstra, you know, in any sport, but pull off an upset like this. And as Coach mentioned, basically anybody in the top 40 on a given day can take out somebody. But he was being very modest and having them, you know, go up to Syracuse, ACC, beat them. Syracuse is ACC. I keep thinking it was Big Ten, ACC.
Yeah.
Big East, all that stuff. But then, you know, Vermont, it's quite a story. So having, you know, you and I spent a bunch of times coming back on buses and vans. I'm sure they're having a great time on that bus ride.
This guy's getting on a phone call trying to promote the program while the guys in the back are jabbing it up.
Right, but here's Division I sports. They just beat the number one team in the nation, and they're bussing it back. They don't have a charter flight.
Mike, they're going to bus to South Carolina next week.
It's unbelievable.
It's crazy.
Can someone... If anybody's out there with it, can you send him on a plane, please?
Some big time sponsor should put him on a charter.
I hope so. Wouldn't you think also in the NCAA tournament, you're getting some kind of revenue sharing, so maybe you can put these guys on a plane?
Maybe. We'll see. Maybe I'll contact Hofstra and find out what they're doing.
Yeah, well, they're tough to go through sometimes. We're hoping at some point to have some basketball folks on from Hofstra. I still try to refer to them as the Flying Dutch, but
that's right.
Yeah, they are the pride. So
516-623-1240 if you want to chime in. We were trying to get Zach Lutz on this week. He had an emergency. We'll get him on for another time. He's also a former Met, but you know, he was around when in, I believe, 2011, Brandon Nimmo was drafted by the New York Mets. And today it seems as if Brandon Nimmo has now been traded to the Texas Rangers, which kind of brings up, you know, the state of affairs for the New York Mets and also for baseball as to kind of the change in the way things are going.
Before we get to the trade itself, I was kind of surprised that he had a no trade clause. Complete surprise to me that.
Do you remember what his contract was, Mike?
Yeah.
The end of 2022, 8 years, 162.
Yeah.
Which means he still has 5 years and over $100 million left on his contract. And he's doing, I don't know if there's money involved, but he's doing a swap with Marcus Semien.
I think they said that the Mets were going to send $5 million.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which is really, you know, a drop in the bucket. when you're talking baseball contracts. But so Marcus Semien, defensive player, can still hit, obviously, but known for his bat.
Three more seasons. More seasons and $72 million left on his 7-year $175, which I guess is, you know, very similar to Nimmo's 8-160 something.
Yeah.
So he's, you know, gonna make a little bit more than Nimmo was, but his hitting has gone down a little bit. Yeah. But obviously the Mets are looking at him as a second base plug, you know, defensive plug right there.
I enjoyed Brandon Nimmo. I thought he was always 100% of the time. Little injury prone, unfortunately. I know he seemed like he always had issues with his neck.
And then last year in the play, or 2 years ago in the playoffs with the plantar fasciitis, he had a tough
for
time
a young guy. I was
fighting through that.
Yeah,
I just felt like here's a guy that's in the Mets organization, and if the injuries weren't there and his consistency stayed there, he probably could have been one of those guys that stayed with the Mets for life, and eventually, you know, his number nine would have been retired. But I just think it got to the point where, Mike, the Mets are in a situation where it's all hands on deck. People could be going and coming, you know, minute by minute. I think Kodai Senga will be traded. I think there's a pretty good chance Jeff McNeil will be traded. And I think the Mets are going to go after pitching, and defense.
What do you think the market is for Kodai Senga?
It's not going to be low, but it's not going to be excessive.
Yeah.
Like, he still has a decent contract for somebody that wants to pick him up, and his upside is there. You know, you look at some of the Yamamoto stuff, like, you think you might catch lightning in a bottle when Senga is healthy. What will they get back for him? I really don't know. Maybe like a good reliever and another prospect pitcher, something like that.
Mm-hmm. So we were talking off air, but the name that comes up is that you believe is Tarik Skrubel.
He has to become a Met, and he has to be their number one and number two. And, you know, if that means giving up a Brandon Sproat, it means giving up Brandon Sproat.
Yeah.
If that means, you know, possibly even giving up a Jet Williams, fine. I got Carson Benj there, you know. You have to do what you have to do to get him here. The only thing is, he is a free agent at the end of next year.
Right.
But if you think this is your year, that you have a shot of making the playoffs with a chance to win the World Series, you need to go get that number one starter.
Well, you would think also, and maybe I'm wrong on this, that you would at least do your best to try to sign him to an extension.
I just don't.
But I know that doesn't really happen in baseball.
No, I don't know. That was kind of the situation with Lindor. They made the trade, and, you know, we went into opening day not knowing if he was going to be signed, and eventually it happened. But I don't know. It could be one of those things where you're making the trade like a Juan Soto, the Yankees did, and at the end of the year, you don't know if he's going to sign with you. But you have to take that chance and think, you know, if he really likes it here in New York and he does well, and we make that trade with three so-called prospects, guys who have barely made it to the major leagues, at this point, you know, that's worth it because you saw what pitching can do for you.
Yeah, I've never been a big fan of trading a lot of prospects for hitters, but I think when you have an elite pitcher like him, who's just, I mean, he's off the charts.
Yeah.
Who's proven he can do it year in and year out, I think that's when I agree with you. You got to pull the trigger on it, do everything you can to get him in because he can't help but pitch to the numbers that he has on the back of his baseball card.
And I think it softens the blow of losing a guy that's been a Met for the last 14 years when you bring in something else. And I think that's what the Met needs to do. But I think, getting rid of Brandon Nimmo, it's you know, you have to understand that was one of their priorities this year.
Yeah, it's not a shock.
Was to dump. And one of them was going to be Nimmo. And I don't know. We can talk about it till February if we want, but the situation with Pete Alonso is going to be fluid for a while.
Yeah.
I don't think he's going to make a decision right away, and I think he could be part of the Mets plans, but I really think that last year the Mets, he kind of fell in the Mets lap. I don't think the Mets are going to actively be aggressive in getting him here now, knowing he says he could be a DH. Maybe they go out and get themselves a first baseman and Pete may fall in their lap as a DH.
So here's a question. Again, you put your GM hat on. I'm not a great. I don't like buying cars. I don't like selling things. So I know business is such a big part of this. Is it bad business for the Mets to say, "Hey, look, Pete, this is what," so it doesn't drag on and drag on like it did last year. This is what we're offering you. Here it is. Take it or leave it. Even from a PR standpoint, like this early to say, "Hey, look, folks, we offered him this. He's saying, no, now we got to go in a different direction.
See, I just don't think it ends there. Like, I think that's nice, but I don't think it's like a, hey, this is what we are, take it or leave it, because I think Boris is always going to go out there and look for more. Yeah. And so I think, you know, coming out there and saying, hey, we offered him X amount of years and X amount of money, and he turned us down, we're moving on. I think that kind of happened last year. And then he came back to the Mets, and the Mets found a way to bring him back on a two-year deal with the chance to opt out after one, which he did. Obviously, the Mets, they give a qualifying offer to those type of guys, Edwin Diaz, Brandon Nimmo, Pete Alonso. And then if they sign somewhere else, you get a 14th, you know, fourth-round pick or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just putting it there. But I think the bigger one besides Alonso is Edwin Diaz. Mm-hmm. I really think that he's going to get close to 5 years and $100 million. And I think the Mets are probably better off spending their money and time trying to bring him back to New York than they are trying to bring back Pete Alonso. I just think you go to Pete and you say, hey, listen, this is kind of where we're at. If you want to go out and search, let him.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't think that that should be the number one priority. I think it should be defense and pitching.
True. And if Pete wants to come back to the team that he's been a member of and holds the home run record for, he has to understand also the team has to be good.
Yeah, and you know what he could do if he really wanted to? He can go out there and get Boris to get him a deal somewhere and then go back to the Mets and say, do you want to match it?
Right.
You know, and will that happen? I don't know.
I think the logical choice for him to land is Boston, but, you know, who knows? I mean, I don't think the Yankees had the money, but could you imagine if he's playing first base in the Bronx?
Yeah, I could see that happening. I could see them going after Tarek Skubal as well.
Yeah.
You know, but I really think, as I said to you before, Mike, before we got on the air, is Clay Bellinger is a good fit for the Mets.
Yeah.
I really think that's a wise place to put your money because he can play left field, he can play first base, and he fits a lot of that stuff that maybe you're missing with Nimmo and Alonso not there. This is going to be a big offseason, though, and I will say this. If you're a Mets fan out there, do not expect anywhere close to the team that they put on the field last year. There's going to be wholesale changes.
So before we wrap up, I'm just curious. You were up in Buffalo last weekend.
Yes.
What was that experience like, and how's the stadium next door looking?
It's looking good. It's getting there. It's not going to have a roof because the way they feel is the workers still have to get to the stadium. So if it's a blizzard, you might as well not even have the game. But it looks pretty nice on the outside. The stadium that they have now, Highmark, it's nice. But, Mike, it's really interesting. And I've never been to Green Bay as well. Mm-hmm. Never done that situation. But you drive in on this, like, one lane in, one lane out road, right? Oh, you can go on the shoulder, whatever. Mm-hmm. And on the way out, they close the right lane so you can drive on the other side of the road. People are just parking on people's lawns and then, you know, charging $40. And then you walk three blocks and you go into the game.
That's amazing.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize that they get like 70-something thousand in this stadium. The new one's only going to have like 62,000.
Wow.
So they probably have more suites and stuff like that. But nice experience. We had a good time.
Yeah.
And nice to see a team in New York win as opposed to watching the Giants just hold on, and then wait, I'm going to give you the game.
Ifs and buts, I know all the time, but they could easily have four more wins this year.
Easily. We've talked every week we come in here, Mike. It's a pen-throwing week.
Well, at least I didn't throw my water bottle this week. My goodness, I'll tell you. Between the Giants, the Jets, they looked hapless, you know, today. They were up early, no shot, but.
Fun show, though.
Yeah, it was. It was good. Dave Magadan was great, and Richard Nuttall. Keep winning, my friend, and love to have him on. Love that accent. Brian Gray's behind the glass, always doing a great job. Chris, as always.
We'll see you soon.
See you in a couple of weeks, and happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.